This is It Cinema Squabble, edition number 11. Oh my God, how do we get to 11? I can't even keep these numbers straight now. I'm actually questioning this to myself.
We're in middle school. We're in middle school now. Is,
yeah, one of those things. We've all grown up.
I didn't like middle school.
Yeah.
Mm. I did.
It could be a hard time on some of us. But so who are we? What do? We are a number of Seattle's film critics. We gather a number of times every week in movie theaters discussing films. We said, you know what? Let's bring it to you in podcast form. And that's exactly what we're doing here tonight. I'm Adam Gerke. With me is Sarah Michelle Fetters from Seattle Gay News and MovieFreak.com.
Hello.
Also, Matt Oakes. Matt, you come to us from Silver Screen Riot.
Yes, that's right.
And also joining us is Mr. Brian Zitzelman over here in the corner.
I'm not as fancy sounding.
Oh, come on. And you come to us from The Examiner, also Zitzel Film, The Blog.
Yes.
So,
yes, indeed.
Lots of films, lots going on. We're almost into the throes of summer passion at this point, but it's still spring passion. And
it doesn't feel like spring.
Sure doesn't. 80 degrees today,
I know,
roughly thereabouts.
That?
Man.
Nobody moved to Seattle. It sucks.
Yeah.
It rains all the
time. All the time. We have nothing.
You look really tan today, by the way.
I saw too much sun. which is also why I'm a little punchy. Let's talk about something that happened last week. Brian, you want to set this one up for us, Tomorrowland,
yeah.
George Clooney and crew.
I'm on the Tomorrowland bus. Tomorrowland comes from Brad Bird, the director behind a bunch of great movies, including Iron Giant, Ratatouille, Incredibles. Stars Britt Robertson as Casey, a teenager with, I guess you'd say, great curiosity, ambition, and optimism. All of these get her in trouble as she tries to save her dad's job. Who works at NASA, yes, of course. As they do, as most dads do.
Dismantling platforms?
That's a job.
Sorry,
you didn't know that's a job. Along the way, Casey is given a pin by a mysterious little girl. Said girl is tied to the world of Tomorrowland, where inventors, artists, dreamers are given free reign to do what they do best. Something Casey is given a glimpse of via the pin. In trying to find the truth behind all this Tomorrowland business, Casey runs into trouble. Robots... Mr. George Clooney. The movie is big and sprawling, and I know some think too much so. In fact, a lot of people are pretty lukewarm at best on this one. Matt, I'm curious. I know you don't like the film largely. What, if anything, do you like about Tomorrowland?
Oh, that's not the question I was prepared to
answer. That's the question.
I was ready to take this apart by the limbs.
I know a lot of people have issues with Tomorrowland's themes, which I'm fine with, you know, we'll get into that. What do you think works at least on the filmmaking, the acting? Is there anything there for you as a disliker of the movie?
Sure. You know, I think that the components of it that do work in and of themselves, just not in like the larger movie. It's one of those things where the pieces, I think, are greater than the sum. Mm-hmm. For instance, I think all the stuff at like the World Fair with little Clooney is pretty good. It's not great, but stuff like that works for me. The ending is horrible. Okay, positive. Think positive.
What in the middle, Chuck? You like the opening, the ending falls apart. Is there a point for
there? Okay, when we get the smiley robots.
Okay.
The smiley robots who could have made great villains. I think we'd all kind of agree that could have been something of interest.
I think they're fine villains.
Yeah, they end up getting completely aborted in the later parts
Smashy
of the
smash.
Film.
Sort of. Really. Kind of. Not really.
But all the stuff in George Clooney's little technical castle that he has out there in the woods, I thought that's some of the best stuff of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
That being said, after that, yeah, we're only getting into negative territory.
I love the Eiffel Tower stuff, I have to say.
Oh,
when they go to the Eiffel Tower.
Oh, that's so bad. Oh, it's so bad.
It's all steampunky. I thought that was kind of fun.
That's a clear changing point in the movie, because literally it's going from George Clooney's house to Eiffel Tower. Why does it jump apart, fall apart for you?
Well, okay, so it makes sense to have all this like technical doohickeys out in the woods where no one's actually going to see it.
Mm-hmm.
But when we take that into a public atmosphere like the Eiffel Tower, and we see the Eiffel Tower kind of deconstructing and transforming as if it's in a Michael Bay movie,
mm-hmm.
it just totally loses me there. It's so impractical. It's so just borderline stupid that I was just immediately out of the moment.
So Matt, does it lose you because you're an adult and no longer a kid?
No, and I hate it made me feel like a kid again defense, because it doesn't happen to me in movies like this where its intent is to try and make you feel like a kid again.
And
it's the same thing with like Pacific Rim. You know, people, oh, it made me feel like a kid again. That's just not the case. There are certain movies, kind of like Aloha, which we'll talk about later, that kind of made me feel like a kid again, but not because it was trying to.
See, and I would, this movie did, it made me want to reconnect with that inner 12-year-old that watched The Flight of the Navigator, that watched Lady Hawk, that watched The Last Starfighter. Movies that, when they were released, were not critically successful, that adults poo-pooed on, that older critics called facile and maudlin and melodramatic, and now are considered classics because my generation came of age with those films. And I can't help but wonder what 10, 11, 12-year-olds 10 years from now, 15 years from now, are going to say about Tomorrowland. Is this the movie that is going to help inspire them? Is this the movie that's going to get them interested in storytelling, interested in greater concepts of the human condition and how we can save ourselves and what we can do with this planet? I really hope it does, because it sparked that in me again. It made me want to reconnect with that again. And that is where I find this film to be hugely successful.
But you say reconnect versus innately capture, because I think some, yes, of those films, I mean, they're considered classics by a certain level, but there's also a level of nostalgia maybe,
sure,
going on there. I mean,
but you like this movie too, Brian. Why did you like it? I mean, you liked it even more than I did.
Yeah, I kind of saw it after everybody else, after the weekend kind of dropped. After it was largely poo-pooed. I didn't even know Sarah was a fan of it. I try to usually come into the show blind as I can. I was just kind of on board for the whole thing. You know, I liked the opening. I liked little Clooney. I liked the little robot girl. I thought she was fun. And the comedy that played with her.
Spoiler alert.
Well, no, I don't think so. We got
cats
robot
out of
people.
The bag
we
on
got
this
robot
one at this point.
There's robot people.
There's robot girls. And who George Clooney, as an adult, 54-year-old adult, is in love with this.
But that's not really, I wouldn't say that's innately accurate. I mean, he has memories of her, and I think because
that's
he went to this other
core
place.
Of the movie.
Maybe, no,
this
not
relationship.
Not the relationship. Maybe bond is a better word, because it's about how he went to Tomorrowland and kind of, it almost stilted his growth. Now, Adam, were you able to see Tomorrowland?
Yeah, I saw
where are you on this? Are you on Team Tomorrowland?
I enjoyed a lot of the film, but my biggest issue with it was the fact that it was so far much all over the place. There were so many things they were trying to bring into this and tie together. The whole escape from his house into Paris, then to go into the space or into the other dimension, I was kind of a little, why did we have to go from one to the other to get out? Why didn't we just go from the house in, you know, or something like that? I thought there was some bloat to the scripting, but I still enjoyed it. I'm kind of with Sarah on this, where I'm going to say Last Starfighter is a perfect example of what this film feels like to me. As a kid, enjoying Last Starfighter and feeling, you know, inspired to go play a video game, thinking that this might make me someday this master astronaut that's going to go save the universe. Right? You know, that sparking that creativity, that concept, that idea of it, that I thought was fantastic. And I see that same here. I see that same spark. Brian Tybel, who's sometimes with us here, his boys walked out of that theater and they were just electric after watching it and totally stoked.
Yeah.
They're the right age. They're in that pocket for kids who want that imagination, mm-hmm, and that trip. And using that as a litmus, I would say, sure, for the kids. As adults, we look at it and go, okay.
Well, and you say that, Adam, and I think that that's really on point. This is, for me, a movie that's intended only for kids. Mm-hmm. Whereas Brad Bird in the past, he's had an ability to kind of court adults into the enjoyment of the film. Like The Iron Giant, I think that there's stuff that works on a child level and on an adult level. Stuff like Ratatouille is definitely filled with inside jokes for adults. There's just a treasure trove of riches, no matter what age you are watching, mm-hmm, that kind of movie. With Tomorrowland, I didn't think that was the case at all. I think that parents bringing their kids to this are going to be bored, by and large. Obviously, there's some dissent in the room here, mm-hmm, but I think that going in, like, there's no in jokes. The comedy is so flat. It's just constantly falling on its face from page one.
I don't think so. But
okay.
That's okay.
That being said,
we'll just agree to disagree on pretty much all of that.
Yeah.
Sarah, theater, rent, skip.
I'm a solid theater.
Okay. And Matt, how about you?
I think we know where I'm at. I'm skipping this
You're
one.
You're skipping it altogether. Yep. Brian,
I'm going theater.
Okay.
Definitely.
And you know what? I'll split the difference on that. I'm going to go rent on this. For the kids,
boom.
Rental later. There you go. Splitting it all down the middle, sort of.
You calling me a child?
No.
For liking this?
Not at all.
Passive aggression.
Scary things. Things that go bump in the night. Poltergeist, Sarah, you saw this.
I guess they're here wouldn't be apropos. It would probably be they're back.
Yeah,
don't you think, Matt?
Yep.
So Matt and I saw this. I think we're going to spend about 5 seconds on it. It is Poltergeist. It's mm-hmm. the same movie. It's a small little close-knit family, Sam Rockwell and Rosemary DeWitt. They've got three children. Oldest is a teenager. Middle child is a boy. He's about 10. A little coward. Yeah, a little coward. And then they've got a little girl who can talk to ghosts.
Very adorable.
Does she stand up next to a flat screen TV?
She does. She stands up next to a flat screen TV. She talks to specters in front of her closet, and she is abducted into a ghostly netherworld.
The real mystery, though, is did Steven Spielberg actually direct this one?
No, I don't think so.
there's no mystery. No.
Here's the deal.
It was Toby Hooper.
Here's the deal. The movie is competently well made. Mm-hmm. It's decently scripted. Mm-hmm. It's got a great cast.
The cast is fantastic.
The cast is legitimately fantastic. There is no reason for this movie to exist. All it trades on is your affinity and your memories of the original.
See,
that's it.
I think you're right in this, but I actually did enjoy this more than you, ironically enough, because I feel like this is one that you would come out more in favor of than I. But for me, like Rockwell and DeWitt, they do enough to make this worthwhile. I think over and over and over again, we talk about how these horror remakes are done so that a new generation can get on board. And I feel with this one, that kind of is actually the case.
And I would say no, only because it just retreads every iconic moment from the original film.
Yes, it does.
It just puts them all back out there again, and it does it without context and doesn't take any time to develop anything. And it takes us into the ghost world, which it never should have done.
Okay.
I like the ghost world.
I will finish up by saying Gil Kenan, the gentleman who made the movie, he already made a Poltergeist remake. It's called Monster House. It's animated. It's awesome. Watch that instead.
Okay. So Poltergeist, Sarah, where do you sit?
Skip.
And
ooh, I'd rent this one.
Rent from Matt. Okay. So it goes. All right. Talking about other films that we were interested in, a number of them, we were trying to choose between Good Kill and Slow West, but, you know.
Well, I mean, Slow West is the better film.
Okay.
So I think we should probably go there. If anybody wants to know about Good Kill, I think a lot of us have reviewed it, haven't we?
Yep.
So
I reviewed it at my site.
MovieFreak.com.
Yep. SilverScreenRiot.com.
SilverScreenRiot.com. AdamGurkey.com has mine. There we go.
Not Brian.
The consensus is, I think we all agree Ethan Hawke is terrific in it.
Yes. Sure.
So let's talk about Slow West, shall we?
Sure.
All right. Slow West is a old school Western. It's about a Scotsman named Jay Cavendish, played by Cody Smith McPhee, who has come to the U.S., to find the woman he loves. He is on the trail. He is rescued by Silas Selleck, played by Michael Fassbender, and they slowly trek across the West to go find his lady love.
Sounds riveting.
And it is.
Tis.
Oh.
Yeah. Tis.
I was being facetious.
It's a beautiful, old school, exquisitely photographed Western. John McLean, who is, I'm sure Brian is going to tell us a lot about John McLean because he's a veteran songwriter, composer, something like that. I don't really know a lot about him.
I know he was in the, he's basically the lead member of a band known as the Beta Band.
Okay.
Of course.
Out of the Aussie area.
Yeah. I think he makes a sparkling debut. This is a beautiful.
Sparkling.
I'm down. I'll call it sparkling.
It's a beautiful Western. Okay. Really, really well done. And it builds to a climax that has a resolution you honestly do not see coming.
And I think that this is another great thing about this movie is it feels homaging at the same time as also really treading into new territory. Like this feels like a Western movie made in 2015. It doesn't feel like a Western movie made in the 60s or the 90s. It feels very current.
But it still pays respect.
It does.
To the genre.
But there's so much about it that feels timely, that feels new, and that feels fresh. And Brian, I know that you and I were in a heated conversation where you were saying completely the opposite.
You're on the other side of this hickory stick.
I seem to have been cornered into the dislike camp when it's really much more, I think it's a supremely mediocre camp. I think it's largely well acted. I think it's well shot in the sense that they're shooting in pretty areas and there's a couple nice shots here and
where do you see problems with this?
I think the characters are really light, particularly the Fassbender one. I mean, Fassbender's good and he's charismatic.
He's a classic gunslinger.
He's classic to the point of nothing new, nothing interesting.
I mean, completely disagree.
Mm-hmm. What's new is in this particular
character?
Beyond the fact that he's a naturally good performer.
What I think is wonderful about this performance and about this character is what is unsaid, what you don't know about him, and what you have to glean entirely from the performance and entirely from how he interacts with other people. The fact that Silas allows a Scottish brogue to filter into his accent occasionally gives you real huge clues as to who he really is and what his final intentions are. When he shows up at Rose's house, you don't really expect him to do what he ends up doing. And it's because of the little teeny hints that are littered throughout the film that get you to that point.
I think one of the key through lines for this movie, and one of the things that really cements it as great, is, and I'm probably going to misquote it, but something along the lines, and I think Ben Mendelsohn's character here, who is phenomenal, by the way. All you have to do is plop him in a fur coat.
He looks
and have
great,
him smack
but there's
around.
Nothing there.
Oh, it's great. Okay, he's like weird and effeminate and like kind of like a minx. Anyways, I love Ben Mendelsohn. I could talk about him for days. But the through line is when they say, out in the Old West, only like the dirtiest fighters survive till the end. Like, that's very poorly representing
it's
like the lyricism of what it is.
Not a great paraphrase, but
no.
You are absolutely correct.
Yeah.
Because that is the main point of this film.
Yes.
Which
and that's
comes
what,
through crystal
oh,
clear.
Oh, it does. And like, God, if you take, and I'm not going to spoil anything here, but there's a shot at in the last act of the movie that is just, it's so original. And it's something that we haven't really ever seen before in a movie like this. And that's what makes the filmmaking so unique and feel so fresh. Again, Brian, come on.
No.
Give it over.
No, I'm not. I'm
come
not
to the light.
We're not going to pour salt on his wounds.
No. Obvious jokes aside.
So, Slow West. Sarah, where do you sit?
Extreme theater.
Extreme theater for Sarah. Matt?
I definitely see it in theaters as
okay.
well.
Okay. And Brian?
Skip.
Skip. Boo. Oh, my gosh. I haven't seen it. So
fine,
I haven't seen this,
movies.
So I can't weigh in. So, wow. Okay. What a dipolar sort of thing. Okay, Aloha.
Speaking
Matt,
of bipolar movies,
tell us about Aloha.
Aloha. Aloha is Cameron Crowe's potential comeback. It stars Bradley Cooper as a defense contractor who returns to the Hawaiian Islands, where he first kind of cut his teeth on his biggest deal, and he's guard dogged by a Air Force pilot named Ning, played by Emma Stone, who is fantastic in the film. And he also kind of reconnects with an old flame who he hasn't seen in 13 years, who is played by Rachel McAdams.
Okay. Who's also terrific in the film.
Who is also fantastic. Every performer in this film is just totally on point. Love the performances.
I hear a butt. There's a butt coming.
Where's the other? Yeah, when does the shoe drop?
I'm not dropping the shoe.
There's no shoe
drop.
No
shoe dropping.
Well, he likes it. I mean, I like the film.
Uh-huh.
There's
I think
a lot
he likes
of
it more than I do.
Lot of problems.
So here's the issue. The central story, the stuff dealing with Bradley Cooper's military contractor trying to put rockets into space and the militarization of space and the corporatization of space and NASA's deconstruction and all this other hogwash is poo. The central story does not work.
It's thin.
And you know it doesn't work because at a certain point, you get the feeling that Cameron Crowe, the guy who wrote and directed the movie, doesn't care about the central story anymore.
And there's definitely, yeah, there's some kitchen sinking going on here. But yeah, from my read of the film, if you interpret it as magical realism, which is really the way to approach this if you want to enjoy it, then I think that there is...
I don't know if I'd go there.
I would. It does not take place within the real world. This is not a movie that exists in America, in Hawaii. It's very much kind of a fable.
In some ways, I guess where I would say no is because it's so heartbreakingly authentic.
Yes.
Where it comes to the actual relationships between these characters. What happens between Cooper and Stone? What happens between Cooper and McAdams? The stuff dealing with Cooper and John Krasinski, who plays McAdams' Air Force husband. This stuff is gorgeous. It's beautiful. There's a superb sequence where Cooper and Stone head up into the mountains and they encounter real life Hawaii activist and legend and nativist Dennis Bumpy Kanahale. Is that right?
Sure.
Okay.
I'm actually not a Hawaiian native.
But that's
an important
point to make, though.
And it's a gorgeous sequence because it's so reverential and respectful to Hawaiian culture and the community. and to those islands in general. And it really brings the themes of this film into play in a way that they never could have materialized without this moment.
Which is ironic, obviously, because it's been getting a lot of backlash for being called whitewashed by people who look at the poster and say, wait, where are the natives?
There's a character that Danny McBride plays. He's a colonel that's in charge of a lot of different things. He's there because he's Danny McBride. You easily could have put a native actor into that role and not lost anything.
But you would have lost the impact of a boner joke.
I guess there you
go. No one delivers a boner joke like Danny McBride.
I mean, having lived in Hawaii as a kid, the Navy there is pretty diverse in general, so it doesn't have to be token Danny McBride character. I wonder how much the controversy also deals with, you know, whitewashing is always kind of a thing people are looking at, and it's kind of a consistent issue. Isn't Emma Stone like half Chinese?
She's a quarter.
Also
a part or like half Swedish, and we all know that the Swedish genes totally triumph the over the
do we know?
Wow.
Yeah,
okay.
If you're a geneticist, like
Darwin speaks.
I don't know. I guess I'm partial Swedish, so there you go.
There you go. You got the blonde going for it. So theater, Rent, Skip, Matt.
I'd see this in the theater, and which is funny because it's just getting trounced, but I really liked it.
Okay. Sarah?
Even with my reservations, I would actually still see this in the theater because the stuff that's great,
it's great,
is legitimately fantastic. And it has one of the best endings I've seen this year.
It's
the last scene of this film ripped me in two.
There are problems in this movie.
Yes.
But I think that there are problems that you're able to overlook if you fall in love with the film, which I did.
Okay. So, Brian, you know what you and I are going to do this weekend then. So
I'm gone.
We've got our homework cut out.
Matt and I are on our little Aloha Island.
Now, yep. Okay. Aloha. And perfect. Hawaii, threatened by earthquakes, but in this case happens to be... well, the San Andreas Fault, which brings us to more earthquakes. San Andreas comes out this weekend as well. Sarah, tell us a little bit about earthquakes and phenomenon of San Andreas.
It's The Rock versus an earthquake.
Okay.
There really is not.
That is the plot.
I mean, if you want to like break out the plot, there's basically...
Rock saves his daughters.
There's two chunks of the movie.
And
there's
his wife.
And his ex-wife.
There's Paul Giamatti as like a seismologist, and that stuff's kind of all left to the side just so he can occasionally come into the movie and say, this one's a 9.1. That's almost the biggest. This one's a 9.5. That's tied for the biggest. And so on and so on. But mostly it's about The Rock, his soon-to-be ex-wife, and his daughter who doesn't want Mama and Papa to divorce.
So you guys said, and I'm coming at this from not having seen the movie.
Good
you say
move.
The movie is The Aww. Rock versus The Rock versus an earthquake.
That's
and
the movie.
That actually sounds pretty good to me. So why,
or The Rock
why
versus
is it so bad?
A rock. Yeah,
I don't think it's that bad.
It's not that it's horrible.
Uh-huh. It's a disaster movie.
But that's grading on.
It's grading on the disaster movie scale
on a major curve. There's nothing. I mean, disaster movies kind of have to work on some particular level. Either like the characters have to be particularly interesting or funny or something. This movie does not have that.
Oh, I don't know if I'd go there.
It has to have something truly new, something wow, either in the effects or the scale.
How are the effects?
The effects are fantastic.
The effects are fine, but there's nothing. Have you seen a giant tidal wave destroy City, Adam?
So it's 2012.
Have you seen a boat try to go over like a big tidal wave?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah,
2012.
You've seen that in 2012. I mean, have you seen... buildings crash apart. We've seen all this.
Does a helicopter narrowly escape?
Good, but I mean, that's like, I don't know. I just think that's grading on. That's like going to a crappy period piece and saying the pants are really accurate to 19th century France. Who cares if everything else is not good?
I actually appreciate the fact that this is a lot simpler than most disaster movies we've seen of late. The world is not in jeopardy.
What do you mean the world's... like, at least millions of people die in this movie.
No, and I get that. But in the grand scheme of disaster movies, this is a lot smaller in focus than what we've seen of late. And as such, it gets to keep its attention squarely on its three main characters.
Who are
fun and interesting, and they all do a good job.
There's nothing to any of them. In fact, it might... be the final nail that just proves The Rock should not be a leading man in anything.
Oh,
he's really good.
Oh.
He's a great spice and stuff, but as a leading man, he is boring.
I disagree with that. I think he's actually like,
there's a fairy, tooth fairy dude.
Oh, come.
This is The Rock's acting in this movie. Is him going? Something's hard's coming. He's flying. Oh, earthquake.
This is a visual. What you aren't at home seeing on this is Brian is clenching his fists and
it doesn't. You don't even need the fists. It's just him staring ahead and going.
And I think that's underselling how good he actually is in this film.
Even Carla Gugino's bad, and she's never bad.
And I again disagree with that. I think you just don't like disaster movies.
I like Deep Impact decently. I can enjoy Armageddon. You know, you've got
Armageddon isn't that good.
It's better than this.
No, I'd say they're pretty much on par.
I have a good friend I went to see this movie with last night who's she watches Day After Tomorrow probably every two or
and
three
that
weeks.
Is
and
terrible.
She
That's
a problem. Said this was worse.
Wow.
No.
That being said, Sarah, where do you sit?
Well, on the Poseidon Adventure scale, I would say this is a solid rental.
Okay.
If the Poseidon Adventure is what you would say is theater.
Okay. Matt?
Didn't see it.
Didn't see it. So, all right. So you and I are both
Maybe
removed
I will.
From this.
Maybe
yeah.
I will.
And Brian?
Do we have something below skip? Skip.
Skip. So we got a rental and a skip. So we're getting pretty low marks here. That being the case, we had the chance to actually sit down and talk with the producers of a film playing at SIFF, the Seattle International Film Festival. The film is called Love Among the Ruins, and we had a chance to talk with Susan Harmon and Richard Meyer. Take a listen to this.
The easiest way to get into Love Among the Ruins is just to pull right out of the Seattle International Film Festival's catalog and read their description of this crazy, crazy, fun, hugely enjoyable little film. Love Among the Ruins. It's the North American premiere. It's the restoration of a long-lost 1922 silent Italian melodrama about a World War I set romance between a middle-class ingenue and an idealistic soldier. It's the subject of a perfectly crafted spoof that recalls Forgotten Silver and The Artist.
Okay, so did I happen to mention, Sarah, we have the producers here
and one of the subjects of this documentary.
So Susan Harmon and Richie Meyer, thank you very much for being here with us.
We're happy to be here.
My pleasure.
So tell us a little bit about where the film came from for you guys to begin with, because as we all started watching this, we're going, well, this is interesting. Who came up with this nutshell?
Well, here's what happened. Every year for about 20 years, we go to a silent film festival called Legionato di Cinema Muto in Pordenone, Italy. And we met this young guy there a few years ago who had this great idea because he loves silent films. He wants to get young people to understand about silent films. So his name is Massimo Ali Mohammed.
And he's Italian.
Okay.
And I decided I wanted to study more Italian after I stepped down from a career in public radio. So I said to my husband, who is Richie Meyer, that's another connection, I wish we were spending more time in Italy. And he said, well, I remember meeting this guy at Legionate.
And I had seen his other films. He hadn't made a feature film, Ali, but his short films were hilarious. They were spoofs. They were surrealistic. They were just wonderful. I'll give you one.
Yeah, tell him about the one about the church and the pornography.
He lives in
the church and pornography.
Yeah, wait a minute. Okay. Yes. All right. They live in this wonderful Renaissance town called Ferrara. It's a UNESCO heritage site. And in this town, the Catholic Church had an extra church because nobody was showing up at this church and they had other churches. So the Monsignor said, what are we going to do with this church? Let's sell it. So somebody said, hey, there's a man looking to start a movie theater and he wants to do it in the old Renaissance part of town. So the guy came and he bought the theater from the Monsignor. And the Monsignor says, I'm so happy. You'll be able to show films for children who can't go to the modern duplexes outside of the walls of the city. They can go right.
But it didn't happen that way.
No. What happened is he made a porn theater. Then Ali got this great idea to make a film about it, and they interviewed these people coming into the church with the raincoats, you know, the type. And he would interview somebody. He says, how do you feel about coming to this porn theater? He says, it's wonderful. It's in a church. It's holy.
So we thought.
And then, so when I saw that film, I said, this guy has what a sense of whimsy. So he and I were talking about what could be a good idea for a film. And he said, I just want to make a silent film. I said, maybe what we should do is have a doc about the silent film and then show the silent film.
Well, and the part of the thing here is what's true, what's not true. There really was this. This film has something about a dirigible, a big thing in the air that drops bombs and stuff during World War One. That was really true. That dirigible existed in Ferrara. So some of the things are true, some aren't, sort of like today in terms of the internet and what you know or don't know. So.
And the whole idea of this story, which I love, is, again, a fact. There was a huge earthquake in northern Italy in 2012.
Yeah, well, that's what I love about this movie is that you take the real earthquake, which really happened and was quite catastrophic and caused tons of damage all throughout Italy. But then you posit this idea of a lost silent film hidden in a wall.
And the crack opens up.
Yeah.
And they find it.
But which is very believable because these things do happen.
Right.
Especially in these ancient buildings, a lot of these buildings, the stuff in those walls was just put there to stabilize the wall.
Well, and that's part of the joy of this thing because art is being found. So that whole process is sort of exciting. And all those people in the first part of the movie that's a documentary, they're all real. They all played to talk about the ever-popular Lumini brothers.
Yes, and we created this fictional film company run by the Lumini brothers. One was a barber, and so he was very good at cutting film. And the other brother was a grave digger, and so he was the cameraman. And he used, for lighting, he used grave lamps. And one of the things that's so great about the film is that, in a way, in early silent films, they tried everything to light the sets. And it's just amazing. The other thing that I like about this film is that they keep finding lost films for real.
Like what you said,
In fact, I was in New Zealand at the Film Archive, and they had found about 50 or 60 American Hollywood films from the 20s that were lost forever, including the first John Ford comedy, not a Western, Upstream. And everybody said, these are lost. What happened is they would send the films from Hollywood to New Zealand, and then they kept them because it was too expensive
to ship
really
them back. Nobody really looked at them, and then they found them in the back of the archive. The other thing about this film is when you get into the silent film part, our director, Ali, really got into doing it just as if it were
made in
1922.
Yeah, that's what I was just about to ask. I mean, was there ever thought of taking shortcuts, to ease it, to make it more modern? Because you said you want to have it in a manner that makes people like the old silent films. Was
Absolutely.
There ever worry that you got to cut some corners?
No, and you know what? I refer to this project as our, what is the word, artisanal, in the sense that everything was perfectly made on this. I mean, the costumes were period costumes. All the props were exactly of that time. He never wanted any shortcuts.
And also, he didn't create these things in a digital way.
Right.
He shot it in a way that they did it in the 1920s. We had a professional cast of actors who came from Rome. One guy was in a soap opera for 8 years on Italian television, and we would go into a restaurant with him, and they said, oh my God, it's Eduardo. And he plays the father in this, and he's terrific. So the cast loved to do it. They thought, when in our lives can we make a silent film? And they were wonderful. The other thing, the locations were all historical buildings from Ferrara, which is, as I mentioned, a UNESCO heritage site. And we shot in castles, in mansions with original artwork where they don't allow still photography for tourists. They gave us permission to shoot with lights and everything.
And let me say here that Ali got all those locations given to the film. And he even went to this mansion where this woman answered the door and said, are you a thief? He said, no, I'm a filmmaker. And she let him in for the day to do all the stuff.
And it was the same place we shot scenes in the garden where they shot the Garden of Fizzicantini, which was made in Ferrara.
So you've got this time capsule put together. Have you had trouble with people who don't understand that this is somewhat fictional?
Well, this is a big issue because when we tested the film with a small group, some people got outraged after they found out that it was a spoof. So, you know, if you have to stay through the credits to see the outtakes. But so we decided we can't say it's a mockumentary because that suggests hilarity and not everybody understands. This is very subtle. There are a lot of little motions in this, but you're not going to just go guffaw around this thing. So we chose the word spoof because we thought maybe you would enjoy the silent film and the documentary more if you knew that it was a fabrication, sort of. But people still forget. They still forget.
I do wonder, I mean, other than wanting to do it, mm-hmm. I mean, and obviously there is a joy in that, in just wanting to see something like this happen. What is the ultimate point of the film? What do you think is the driving force behind it? I mean, are we bringing attention to mm-hmm. the idea of film preservation? Are we...
Yeah. I think so, and I'll answer. For me, it's the artistic side of it and the beauty of it, and that somebody created this, and sort of a sense of nostalgia and irony about this whole package that was going on that we're not so familiar with. And one thing we did do is we commissioned Donald Sosin to do the music, because one message we want to get out is that silent films were an equation between the film and the music. And Donald's also actually going to play here for Cave of the Spider
Woman.
Yeah, he's going to be here another night, but he did the score for this. That's what I get out of the film.
The other thing is, it's to introduce people to silent film who have this just idea that somehow silent films, A, were silent, B, were hammy and had these crazy gestures, and it was an art form. And for example, I teach film in my spare time at Seattle University, and when you mention silent films to students, they go, "What? What are you kidding?" And then they find out it's black and white, although they did Technicolor in silent film. Mm-hmm. They go, "Black and white? Oh my God." But I said, "Look, why don't you look at MTV and you'll see some great silent film techniques, because all of the techniques that we think are great now, digital effects, whatever, all were invented and developed in silent film.
They have their roots there. So, and I think also just your point about opening a wall and finding something, that's just a good story. So everything's sort of about the story.
The story in the film itself, beside the mockumentary, is so true about the First World War. Most people don't realize that Italy, when 1914 was on the German side, but in 1915, the British said, "You come over to our side, and we will give you land when we win the war." And they said, okay. So they declared war on Germany and Austria, and they fought the rest of the war against Austria. And here this little city of Ferrara decided to launch a dirigible, which in World War I was pretty, pretty famous. And it was called the City of Ferrara. And on its first mission, it got shot down. And so one of the characters in the film is a young soldier who has the fortune of being on the first flight of the dirigible. And he tells his love, "I'm going on this very important mission."
Don't tell
mission.
Anymore.
No, no,
give
no.
Give the end of it. Okay.
It's like, wait, we're gonna spoil the climax here.
No,
there's more.
Yeah. So I know we're running out of time, but what are our hopes for this film after it screens at SIFF this weekend? What do you want it to do next, and where do you go from here?
Well, we hope that it'll be in a few more festivals after its North American premiere, and then of course we want distribution. We want more people to get to see it, so we're looking for a distributor.
It was seen in Italy at the Verdano Festival, and it got very good reviews. So it's been seen in Italy, and of course the Italians love movies, and I think we do too.
So sadly, I think I'm the only one of the three of us that have watched it all the way through.
All the way through, but Brian and I are working on
okay.
it right now.
They will.
So I'm going to sit there and I'm going to say theater.
Okay.
I think it's awesome, and I want people to go and watch this film.
Where can you see it?
The film is called Love Among the Ruins. You can see it at the SIFF Uptown Cinema, and that's June 4th and 5th. June 4th at 7 o'clock, June 5th at 3:30. And Susan Harmon and Richie Meyer for Love Among the Ruins, thank you much for joining us.
Thank
you. My pleasure.
Thanks so much, guys.
Thank you.
So there you go. Love Among the Ruins. Details at SIFF.net on tickets and information on screenings and all of the above.
And so, I think for the three of us that watch that movie, I think we'd all say go see it, right?
It's enjoyable.
Yeah, it's worthwhile.
It's really worthwhile. Yeah.
That being the case, a lot of films playing at SIFF right now that we really kind of have to cycle through a bunch of these things.
The Last Week. Brian, what do you want to talk about, Brian?
I mean, we have one that's there's a very strange scenario because, I mean, we even though we're 11 years old by podcast terms or whatever.
Uh-huh.
There's this film, Chatty Caddies, that has kind of arranged itself with us. It's made posters with quotes of ourselves. We've referenced it in Avengers. For some reason, they just heard me talk about Baron Bells enough that they just know that I'm a cat person.
You've got a soft place in your heart for cats.
I have a soft place in my heart for cats. So Chatty Caddies is a very, very small kind of, I guess, comedy, drama, dark comedy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's a fine enough movie. I know, Adam, you saw it. Sarah, I know you saw it. There's interesting stuff in it, and it is one of those movies you say there's interesting stuff in it.
I think this will be a polarizing film.
Yeah, sure.
And it's based, and there isn't really much to it. It's just there's people and cats talk to them. And Sarah thinks something with the cats is particularly interesting.
So all the cats are portrayed by deaf actors.
Mm-hmm.
Which is interesting.
But what I love about it is that it ends up not being a trick.
Mm-hmm.
It actually gives these cats their own sort of, gives them their own language, gives them their own dialect that is something that we just haven't heard before. And it's unique. And I really like that. And I found myself getting lost within that. The movie's odd. It's very thin. I don't think it's as darkly funny as it wants to be.
And
but
Adam
it's worthwhile.
Yeah. No, I love cats, man. I'm kind of with Sarah on this, though. I felt it a little thin, not quite my cup of tea. Just going to be a harder sell on me for that one. But there are other films that we love.
But there's so much.
SIFF is loaded, and I know I'm particularly pumped to see. I'm a big David Foster Wallace fan, the famous author who passed away several years ago. He's the main subject of a movie coming out this weekend called End of the Tour. Jesse Eisenberg's in it. Jason Segel's in it, playing David Foster Wallace himself. And Matt, I know last time you were on, I think it was right after Sundance, you'd seen this. You're a big fan. Is it your favorite movie of the year? Is that fair to say?
I'm at 96 as of today movies I've seen this year, and this is still sitting at my number one.
So I'm stoked. I know.
Nice.
So for people in Seattle, it's playing this weekend. It's playing Saturday. It's playing Sunday.
It's a must see.
End of the Tour.
End of the Tour.
End of the Tour.
Yeah. The End of the Tour.
SIFF
it's from James Ponsoldt, who did Smashed, did Spectacular Now, both solid movies. Looks really good. Matt, other than this, which obviously comes with your highest of recommendations,
yes,
very high, very recommended. Mm. What else should we be keeping our eyes on over the next 2 weeks?
Okay, there's one I really want to talk about because I feel like it's one that could kind of not be on your radar, but it should be. This is called Lamb. It's a film by a director-actor named Ross Partridge. He stars in it and directs it, and it's kind of this fable, like Americana fable, about this man who begins a friendship with a young girl and takes her out into the countryside. And I'll let you kind of think about the implications that come with that.
Is the young girl a robot?
She's not a robot. She's played by Una Lawrence, who is just fantastic in this film. Like, she could earn a Oscar nomination for this. Okay. I wouldn't be surprised.
Rattle off a couple others that you want us to see. Dylan.
Yeah. That one's phenomenal. Sleeping with Other People from Leslie Headland.
I watched that too.
So funny. So funny. And I love the chemistry between Jason Sudeikis and Alison Brie. They're just phenomenal.
I'm going to chime in on that. Buy your ticket. Go. It's fantastic.
So good.
Sleeping with Other People.
Yes.
Okay.
Seven Chinese Brothers, I really liked. Very, very, very dry, acerbic humor. Jason Schwartzman kind of playing a schlub. If you like Jason Schwartzman, you're going to like this.
And Jason Schwartzman's going to be here.
He is. I can't wait to talk to him. And let's see. I'll rattle off one more. Oh, Deathgasm. That's a lot of fun. It's a New Zealand horror gore film.
So is this
very campy.
Is this a midnight screening, a midnight adrenaline?
They already did the midnight.
Okay.
I saw it at the midnight screening a couple weeks ago.
Right.
They're doing it. They're doing the last night at the Egyptian.
Okay. Yep.
It's not midnight, but it's like 9:30.
It's the
last
later. Night. It's the last screen. Show at the Egyptian for the festival.
Okay. As it should be.
Deathgasm.
Yes. Ridiculous.
Oh, and you should say it just like that.
Okay.
Always.
That's right. It was the heavy metal one.
Heavy metal one. Yeah.
Oh man. Now I know what I'm going to do on Sunday night.
You need to go.
Sarah, what are you thinking?
Well, I mean, of all things, the one that I kind of want people to go see the most is the director's cut of 54. Mark Christopher, the writer-director, is going to be here. It is a completely different film. Anybody that knows what happened in 1998 with that movie, you already know that there were that the Weinsteins forced Christopher to do massive reshoots, change the tone, the style, everything about that film when it got released. And it was a major failure. A lot of people don't hate it as much as critics did at that time, and it sort of developed its own cult following, but it was not even remotely what Christopher intended. So 30 minutes of the film were taken out completely, excised, gone. 44 minutes that were originally shot are put back in. This movie goes from being an interesting curiosity piece to an essential bit of dark, hedonistic 70s style cinema that needs to be seen. Ryan Phillippe is terrific in it. It's his first great performance because he was 17 when he made it. Breckin Meyer, whose role was pretty much destroyed in the theatrical version, is glorious. And I would say, I mean, nobody likes to deal in hypotheticals, but before the movie was released, everybody was assuming that Mike Myers had a shot to get an Oscar nomination for this movie. Had this version of the film been released, I think it would have happened.
Okay. It could have saved us from having The Love Guru, Austin Powers 3, Cat in the Hat. This is your fault, Weinsteins.
This movie goes from being interesting to very, very good to borderline great. I've watched it twice. It has its premiere tonight. And then it's going to be on digital HD starting, I believe, June 2nd.
And that's Studio 54.
That's 54, the director's cut.
54, just 54.
Adam, anything for you?
There's a couple of them that I'm really hot on right now. The first being Mr. Holmes. That's looking at...
Yes.
You're not going to do your English accent for this?
Mr. Holmes. Yes. And so that's Ian...
McKellen.
Sir Ian McKellen. Have some decency.
So it's Sir Ian McKellen, and he's playing an old... Sherlock Holmes. He's ready to retire. He is retired.
There's
30 years retired, and he's got this one case that's been holding him up and just kind of like gnawing at him. It's actually the case that made him quit, and so he kind of has to find closure to this, all the while tending to a family, helping him on his estate. So fantastic film. It has a lot of strings, and they all get tied together nicely, including a little World War II bit to it. Really fantastic. Mr. Holmes. Also, It's So Easy, which is the Duff McKagan documentary of sorts. Not really a documentary, but a recounting of some of his, tales of being in Guns N' Roses for a number of years and his tales of being a musician. And I've met Duff. I've heard some of his stories in person. He's a riveting storyteller. If this pans out at all how he is in person, it's going to be a great one. So It's So Easy is one I'm keeping an eye out for as well.
Hey, I want to throw out there, I know it doesn't need any of our help. It's going to sell out both of its screenings. But if you get a chance to go see Inside Out, Pixar's new movie, go.
Yeah, you'll be kicking yourself in the butt if you don't see this as early as possible.
Exactly.
Inside Out from Pixar. All right, so reviewing tonight what we've seen, Tomorrowland. We've got two in the theater, one rental, and one skip from the Squabblers. Looking to Poltergeist, splitting this one in the lower category. We've got a rental and a skip out of Poltergeist. Talking Slow West, two Squabblers saying seeing this in the theater, one saying a skip, so that's a very divisive film, apparently. And we're talking Aloha, two strong theaters recommendations, and San Andreas, also another lower recommendation. Did I say San Andreas already?
No,
San Andreas. Got a rental and a skip out of San Andreas. So all sorts of things being...
We didn't all agree this week.
We absolutely did not.
Yeah, take that.
I know, right?
Real quick, what else are folks working on? Sarah, you've always got something in the hopper.
Well, speaking of 54 again, I actually interviewed writer-director Mark Christopher earlier this week. We talked for like 40 minutes. I've got an in-depth piece in the Seattle Gay News. I'm also going to be posting on MovieFreak.com. Read it. I'm really happy with it.
Exciting. And Matt?
Still in the throes of a lot of SIFF coverage. Got some reviews coming out, doing some capsule stuff, and a bevy of interviews, including just talked to Kevin Bacon yesterday, doing a Schwartzman piece, Patrick Bryce. Just a lot of fun interviews. So,
and Brian,
I don't know, you got any ideas? I'm working on my contrarian thing. I'm halfway done with that. I'm working with Brian, the movie guy, as the voice of the people, the common man, to play my ideas off of.
Well, that's kind of
Wow, we'll have to bring him back, and we can talk about this when you're done.
Yeah.
He's a common man.
The one thing I've got going on is this weekend with SIF. As a part of SIF on Saturday, there's a Catalyst conversation happening, and I'll be moderating a bunch of directors and composers, and we're going to be talking about the connection between directors and composers and helping aspiring filmmakers strengthen that connection.
And when is that?
That's going to be Saturday, and I believe it's 2:15 at the SIF Center. So that's not the Seattle Fairgrounds, or Seattle Center.
Right across from Key Arena.
Exactly. So there you go. The Catalyst Conversation, you can look that up at SIF.net. And all of the information about us, you can find at cinemasquabble.com. You can also find us on iTunes. And if you get that chance, do give us that rating so much. We would appreciate it.
We would purr in appreciation.
I would.
I'm a dog person, so.
This has been Cinema Squabble. Post-production on this production comes to us from Squawking Vulture Studios. And many thanks to Sprints Arbogast, our producer.